Welcome to Cambridge Forum with Rabbi Michael Lerner, discussing his new book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. I'm Bernard Steinberg, president of Harvard Hillel. Why do so many Americans vote against their own economic interests? How has the political right used its alliance with the religious right to achieve social dominance? Why has the political left failed to tap into Americans' deepest values? Internationally renowned theologian Rabbi Michael Lerner examines the new roles that religion and faith play in American political life in his new book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. He argues that the right presents a self-serving and distorted vision of traditional religious values, while the left ignores the spiritual needs of the American people and shuns meaningful discussion of values. How can American leaders re-engage with citizens' spiritual values to force a meaningful vision of progressive politics? Rabbi Michael Lerner is internationally known as the editor of Tikkun magazine, a bi-monthly Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society. He earned one PhD in philosophy from the University of California, Berkeley, and another in clinical psychology from the Wright Institute. He is rabbi of Beit Tikkun Synagogue, which meets in San Francisco and Berkeley. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Rabbi Michael Lerner.
Thank you. Delighted to be here with you this evening and to try to answer some of the questions that I try to do in a deeper, fuller way in the book, and start by saying that I was involved in research on this question for the last 25 years. Started with an NIMH-funded research project in which we were interviewing thousands of middle-income working people. We started around issues of stress and work and family life. But at the same time, we began to ask other questions that NIMH wasn't funding us to ask, about why it was that people whose economic interests would have led them to support the Democratic Party or liberal or progressive politics were moving politically to the right. And we held groups that were lasted for 8 to 10 weeks and learned about people's lives. And what we learned, and I'll sum it up in one sentence, we learned there's a deep spiritual crisis in American society and that people felt that the right was speaking to that crisis and the left was not. What was that crisis? Well, we listened to people's lives and the stories of their lives, and what they told us was about the psychodynamics, first of all, of the world of work, of what it was like to be them. Because for most people in our society, most of their waking hours are spent in the world of work and in travel to and from. So that the dynamics of the world of work, the way in which people come to perceive themselves and the world that happens in the world of work, has a monumental impact in shaping how they view themselves in the world in the few hours awake that they have outside the world of work. And what was it that they were learning? They were learning day after day, week after week, month after month, that there is a bottom line in the world of work. That the bottom line is to maximize money and power for someone, usually for the owners of corporations or for the owners of the stores that they worked in, if they were fortunate enough to be independent professionals, then they were maximizing the bottom line for maybe their group of lawyers or their group of doctors or whoever that they were in it. But they very clearly got a very powerful message that the task was to maximize the bottom line. By the way, in some who worked in nonprofit institutions, there was also the factor of maximizing the ego needs of the people at the top. But these were the factors that people learned as the bottom line. And as they were learning the bottom line, they were simultaneously learning that every other person in the workplace had to be viewed, and every other either as a potential client if they were not employed in the workplace, or as a potential ally and assistor in maximizing the bottom line, in being able to prove to your boss or to those who are in power that you as an individual or your work unit or increasingly even the entire operation that you're part of, which is now part of a larger corporate structure, that is in fact going to maximize the bottom line. And if it isn't, you personally may be downsized, your work group may be downsized, your whole factory, your whole workplace, your whole project may be eliminated. So maximizing the bottom line and learning to see other people primarily in terms of, can they be of use? How can I get help from this other person? How can this other person assist me in being able to show to those who have power in this place that I am important to them? Another way of putting this in religious language, we say, is we were unlearning how to see other human beings as created in the image of God and learning how to see them from an instrumentalist point of view, what they can do for me, how they can be of use. Now, the problem that happens when people spend all day long internalizing this, internalizing it in a language that is best summed up as looking out for number one, was the best-selling book of the 1980s, was called that, Looking Out for Number One. People bought it because they thought they didn't know how to do it well enough and that there were other people, obviously the people who ran their corporations or ran their workplaces, who were much better at looking out for number one than they needed to learn the skills, internalize, how do you do that? But when people spend all day thinking in those terms, they bring that home into their personal life. Now, what we learned in our research was that that people firmly believe, having come home from a day like this, that that is what they call the real world, that that's the real world. It's the world where they get the money to pay for their food, their children's education, their mortgage, and so forth. So that's the real world. And they are absolutely certain that that cannot be changed, that that's the way the world is, it's fixed. And simultaneously, they believe that it's something that runs totally counter to who they are. And so very many, many people feel both stuck in that real world. In fact, if you tell them that it can be changed, their first instinct is to say, that's utopian, that's fanciful, that's adolescent to believe that it can be changed. That's the real world. There's nothing we can do about it. And simultaneously, they feel dirtied by it. They feel conflicted about having been part of it. And both of these things are going on at the same time in most people's consciousness. So you'll pardon me that in the way that I'm talking, I'm giving these sweeping generalizations that are that come from, we did over 10,000 people in groups, okay? That was this wasn't a small little research project, a huge research project. We had over 10,000 people. I'm summarizing a huge amount of data, and I'm talking about a tendency. Not every person fits exactly in the same way in the tendencies that I'm talking about, but these are overwhelming tendencies. So people bring home from the world of work this consciousness. They bring it home and they then find themselves in situations in which they feel very alone. They don't know who they can count on. They don't know, since they have learned the rationality of the marketplace, looking out for number one, or another way of putting it is, be a rational maximizer of self-interest. That's what it is to be rational, as a maximizer of self-interest. Then they come home and they try to teach their children values, and the children turn on television and immediately see that the values that are trying to be taught to them by parents, by the churches or synagogues, by the mosques, by the ashrams, wherever, are in total, have no relationship to the real world. And their parents know that they're trying to teach them something that isn't, that they don't actually believe could happen in the real world. And so there is this ethical crisis or values crisis in trying to transmit to the next generation the values you hold. Then there's a second level, and that is friendships feel much thinner to people today, because as the market consciousness has seeped into increasing numbers of people, the family friendship relationships become more and more a kind of exchange in which I give to you on the reasonable expectation you'll give back an equal amount of time, energy to me. And the problem with that, you might say, what's wrong with that? That's just how it is in the marketplace, right? Of course, an equal exchange. The problem is that as people get older or as they get sicker, they are not reasonably able to be part of that exchange. They can't really be counted on to give you back an equal amount of energy, time, and comfort, support, whatever. So many, many people in this society report that they feel, particularly as they get older and particularly as they get sicker, that the friendships are no longer what they used to be, because there used to be an element of solidarity. And solidarity meant you were with the other person and there for the other person, regardless of whether you could get a good exchange on your time and energy, whether you could count on getting an equal amount back. You were there for the other person because you cared about the other person, and you were not a rational maximizer of self-interest. So as a result, people report, now you can say, oh, well, there's a certain element of nostalgia here, perhaps fantasy about what friendships used to be. Nevertheless, this is how people experience it, that friendships are less thick, less solid, less countable on. And then in relationships and family life, increasingly, we get in loving relationships a kind of a market relationship, a sense that each person looking around for in a dating world is looking around in a kind of market consciousness, as though they were in a supermarket tasting one product and then another product and then another product and then another product and discarding this one, discarding that one, not necessarily because there's anything wrong with them, but because there are so many other things to taste. So, that is seeing other people primarily from the standpoint of, again, of what good experience can I get from this one? What good experience can I get from that one? Eventually, people do settle down, and many, many make commitments, whether that's in 3 or 4 years of dating or 20 or 30 years of dating, but eventually people do make commitments. And when they do, having internalized the logic of the marketplace, what they've learned all day, what is reinforced in the common sense of the society, they have in their minds a certain level of calculation, let's say, a certain way in which they look for other people through the framework of, what can you do for me? How much can you satisfy my needs? And commitments increasingly, again, I'm talking about a tendency, not an absolute, right? Increasingly, relationships have, commitments have an element, or very often a very strong element of, I'm going to make a commitment to you because amongst the people who are likely to fall for me in the short run, you'll satisfy more of my needs than anybody else I can meet. So what's the problem with this? The problem with this is that everybody intuitively knows this. And everybody knows that if they have any respect for their partner, that their partner has probably been somebody who has gotten what it is to be rational in the society. And as a maximizer of self-interest, they've internalized this consciousness. And so to the extent that they've internalized the consciousness, then everyone feels insecure in their relationships, including, now I'm talking not only of the 50% of marriages that end in divorce, but also in the 50% of marriages that don't end in divorce, because people are never sure that their partner can't at some point cut a better deal. And if they can cut a better deal, it seems fundamentally irrational to them not to do so. How could they not do that if they're rational maximizers of self-interest? So please don't misunderstand me here. First of all, the degree of insecurity that people feel is not the same for everyone. And so how alone people feel depends on many other factors, some of which have to do with the individual and their psychic makeup and so forth, but some which have to do with what they perceive to be objective factors. I'm not saying they are objective, but what people perceive to be objective factors, namely their own perception of their own marketability on the marketplace of relationships. Because the younger you are, the more conventionally attractive you are, or the wealthier you are, the less this seems terrifying to you. The older you are, the less conventionally attractive you are, the less financially secure you are, the more terrifying it is to you. So when people talk about the great insecurity in families, it's somewhat affected by their own perception of their marketability. You see what I'm talking about here? You get what I'm saying? Yeah. So but nevertheless, for huge numbers of people, including, as I say, not just the ones whose families will end up in divorce, but the 50% that won't end up in divorce, there's tremendous insecurity and fear that this could happen, that you're never sure that it won't happen. And increasingly, people feel that it's happening all around them, and it may well happen to them, and that they may be thrown into chaos in their own personal lives in ways that they don't know how they can fully handle. Now, I am not trying to blame anyone here. I am not trying to put anybody down or critique anybody. I think it's almost impossible to grow up in this society without having internalized this kind of consciousness, and certainly to live in this society, to work in this society, to become successful in this society in any way, to not have strong elements of this in one's mind. But I say almost because there is another way to think about the world, and it's a way that we call spiritual. And spiritual is, a spiritual way of thinking is that you look at other human beings and you see them as embodiments of the sacred, as holy beings, as fundamentally valuable for who they are and not for what they can do for you, not for what they can deliver, not for how successful they will be, not for how good a cook they are, not for how good a parent they will be, not for how good an earner they will be, not for how much status they will have in the world, but you see them in and of themselves as being beautiful embodiments of the holy. That's a spiritual way of understanding human beings, and the spiritual way of understanding the larger physical world also is relevant here, because for many, many people, when they go out to nature, there is having, to the extent that they've internalized that consciousness, they look around and see the world from the standpoint of, gee, I wonder if there's anything here I can sell, maybe I could turn something here into a commodity and make a buck off of this. So a spiritual consciousness is looking at the world through the standpoint of awe and wonder at and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation. This is a very different consciousness, okay? This is a very different way of thinking about the world. And what we learned in our research is that a huge number of people in this society, middle-income working people, hunger for that spiritual way of being, hunger for that spiritual consciousness, and feel that their lives are less together and less valuable because they can't find it, because they are so much stuck in a world of manipulation, of utilitarian calculation, and in a work world in which they can't see how what they're doing contributes to any higher good than making money for somebody, usually not themselves, but a little bit for themselves also. And so don't get me wrong. It's not that I'm saying to people that people don't care at all about the money. They do care about the money, but very large numbers of people care also about the fact that they want some framework of meaning and purpose for their lives that transcends the materialism and selfishness of the competitive marketplace, and they cannot find it in the larger society. Now, here comes the political right, and particularly the religious right, and steps in and says, well, there's a spiritual crisis in this society. And they're correct. And they say, and that crisis is based on materialism and selfishness. And they are correct. And then they, unfortunately, turn and say, and you know where this comes from? It comes from the special interests who are introducing materialism and selfishness into our society. And who are those special interests? Well, it depends on what country you're talking about, because whoever is the demeaned other of whatever country the religious right is functioning in, that's who the special interest is. So, for example, in Europe, the special interests were the Jews. In the United States, for a long time, the special interests were African Americans and Native Americans. But increasingly, in the last 20 years in this country, the special interest, the primary demeaned other, has now, they've sort of made room for more, and primarily gays and lesbians and feminists. That is, women who have been asking to create a society that repairs the tremendous inequalities that existed before, or gays and lesbians who've asked that, or African Americans who've asked that. And because they're asking to repair the damage that was done to them historically, they're called special interests who are introducing selfishness and materialism. Now, the irony of this is that the right, while acknowledging the spiritual crisis, is simultaneously the primary force in the society that champions the ethos of materialism and selfishness in the world of work. Because in the world of work, in the corporations, the political right has been the primary force insisting that there be no introduction of categories of social responsibility. Whenever people come, either through government or through voluntary organizations like the unions, and say, treat your workers right, pay them enough money so that they can live. Have safety and health regulations in your workplace. Stop polluting the environment. Watch out for what the consequences for what you're producing. The right is the force that has systematically opposed every such attempt to bring other values into the workplace besides the values of maximizing their own money and power. So how do they get away with this? On the one hand, the champion of selfishness and materialism in the world of work in the economy, and on the other hand, the champion of the pain that people feel when they bring that home into personal life. How do they get away with this? Well, the answer is they get away with it because the liberal and progressive forces aren't even in the relevant ballpark and don't have a clue about the spiritual crisis, and hence have allowed the right to become the only articulator of the spiritual crisis. And you see, people tremendously appreciate when they've been suffering and suffering from a source they don't fully understand, that somebody comes forward and names what they're suffering from. And so, just as the women's movement earned tremendous credibility when it was able to help women understand that it wasn't that they were personally screwed up, that there was a screwed up social reality of sexism and patriarchy, so similarly today, the right is able to do this in regard to the spiritual crisis in American society, to help people understand that it's not them that's screwed up, that there's a social reality that's screwed up, that they're, in fact, they are surrounded by a materialism and selfishness that really does hurt them and really does undermine loving connections, and really does make them have good reason to be scared about their loving relationships. But the left, because it has had a long history of fighting against the religion and spirituality as being associated with feudalism, which is where the left emerged from in its struggle 300 years ago, has never developed the categories, the intellectual categories, to understand the spiritual needs of people. Instead, the left focuses entirely on, or almost entirely on, inclusion. That is to say, it looks at the society and says, there are some groups who have been refused equal access to the material well-being of our society or to the political rights of our society, and we want to fight to bring them in so that they can share equally in the material well-being and in the political well-being that the rest of us have. Now, I've been part of the left for the last 40 years, and I am proud of that battle. And I'm totally in solidarity with the left for those battles of inclusion. I think they are extremely important. Only, we're not winning. And we're not winning in part because for a very large section of our population, the issue isn't only their material needs or their rights. For a very large section of the population, they are equally in pain with regard to the deprivation of their hunger for meaning and purpose, the deprivation of their spiritual needs, for the deprivation of a society that can be based on love and caring and generosity and kindness. And that is as fundamental to their need structure, but the left doesn't have a category to capture that. So as a result, when the left hears words like religion or spirituality, immediately they run into, they either say, oh, spirituality, that's New Age mush, or they say, oh, those are simply code words for the racism, sexism, and homophobia of the right. That is, they are correct that the right has manipulated some of that spiritual need and some of the religious needs in a racist, sexist, or homophobic direction. But they miss that there is a real crisis that's being manipulated. Do you see what I'm saying? They miss that there is a reality here, even though the right solution to the reality is destructive. There is something really that the right is addressing. It's a real set of needs. And if we want to change this society, we have to build a way of addressing those needs. That's what led us in Tikkun magazine to begin to create Tikkun out of that research, and then to try to talk to people about this, and eventually to create the Tikkun community's network of spiritual progressives, which we have just started creating in the past year, to try to build an alternative to the political right and to the religious right, to try to talk in a spiritual discourse and to talk about the fundamental, a progressive spirituality that could be an alternative to reactionary forms of spirituality. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's what the book is about. Okay, I'm not going to be able to fully summarize the left hand of God taking back our country from the religious right in the few minutes left, but I do. But we'll have questions and answers. I do want to say here's the fundamental. The fundamental core idea of a progressive spirituality is this: that we need a new bottom line in America, and in fact in all of the West. We need a new bottom line. We need a new definition of productivity, efficiency, and rationality, so that institutions, corporations, social practices are not judged efficient, rational, and productive only to the extent that they maximize money and power, but also to the extent that they maximize love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacities to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacities to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of all that is. This is a very different way. This is a very different conception of rationality. But you have to, if you think, well, wait a second, they didn't teach me that in economics. Right, but where did they get their definition of productivity, efficiency, and rationality? They simply assumed it. They simply assumed that there were no economic tests that proved that rationality was maximizing money or power. That was their belief system that they assumed as their fundamental, as their religion. It was part of the dominant religion of the society, which is not Christianity, but is a certain vision of that what counts is that which can be measured, that the only thing that's real is that which can be measured and subject to empirical verification. But as I'm sure any of you who've taken a philosophy course know, the notion that that which is real is that which, or that which can be known, is that which can be verified through our empirical senses or measured, is a notion which itself cannot be empirically verified or measured. Do you understand what I'm saying here? That the fundamental belief system of the contemporary world, that which is real is that which can be measured or that which can be subject to empirical verification, is a belief system that has no stronger foundation than any other of the belief systems. I'm not against the belief system. I'm just saying I welcome all people's religions, including the dominant one of this society. But most people don't get that they're in a religious system. They think it's just truth. But that's what it is to be in a religious system, is to believe that it's just truth without any argument, you know, without any foundation for it, except that it seems like right to me. Okay, so now what I want to say is this: if you try the new bottom line, you will quickly see that most of our institutions, social practices, and corporations are irrational, inefficient, unproductive. They don't tend to maximize people's capacity to be loving and caring, or kind and gentle or generous, or ethically or ecologically sensitive, or able to see other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, or able to respond to the universe with awe and wonder. So they are fundamentally, by this criterion, irrational, inefficient, and unproductive. I don't mean to say that there aren't a lot of very wonderful, loving, caring, kind, ethically and ecologically sensitive human beings. But most people are that despite the institutions in which they spend all their day. They are that despite it. And in fact, if you speak to people about this, they will tell you that it takes a tremendous amount of courage to continue to hold on to their connection with kindness and generosity and so forth when they're surrounded by a world that seems to negate that and make them feel like a bit like fools for holding on to those kinds of values when the real world doesn't validate that. So another way of putting what we're talking about with a new bottom line in a spiritual politics is we want to reconstruct the institutions of our society in such a way that our interests, namely those that are rewarded by the institutions, are not in conflict, no longer in conflict with our values. See what I'm talking about here? That we can build a society that is not a struggle between what we really believe in and what we're doing all day. But most people are in that struggle. So now what does this turn out to be in concrete terms? How do you go about doing that? Well, partly, I have to say that this is like our movement to have a new bottom line, to have a spiritual politics. We're in the same position as the women's movement was in the 1960s when they started to talk about patriarchy. First of all, we're in the position in which people would said to the women at that point, show us a society that's based on this. Show us something realistic. And of course they couldn't. You know, show us something. Hasn't it always been this way for the last 10,000 years? Yeah, it had been. Well, then you're being very unrealistic to think it can change, right? Well, thank God that women were unrealistic. And as a result of that, there was changes that took place that were way beyond even the most visionary of the women in the second wave of feminism. What actually happened was so far beyond what people envisioned in the mid-60s about what was possible. That is, it's a big mistake to let realism shape your view. We in the Jewish Renewal Movement, as a rabbi, I say realism is idolatry. Idolatry, by that I mean that realism is allowing that which is to determine or shape for you that which can be. Whereas believing in God is believing in the possibility of possibility. It is believing that there is a force in the universe that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which could and should be. And that's why, by the way, I say that many religious people aren't. They don't believe in God. They don't really believe in God. They don't believe that much can change. They end up being compromised with the existing world because they think that's realism and they have to do that. And many people who think they don't believe in God really do. That is, they really do hold to the vision of the possibility of transformation and healing of the world. And that's, in my view, is what it means to believe in God, to believe whatever language you use to articulate that. So I see many religious people as Hellenists in drag. That is, they actually believe that the world is fixed and not much can be changed, and they accommodate to that. But then they do their little, they go daven in the morning, or they go to church or the synagogue or whatever, and they do their little side thing here of religion. So the second thing about what feminism did was it also had the situation of, well, how do you play this out? What would a non-patriarchal world look like? What would it look like to have women's equality? And for a significant period of time, women didn't know the answer. What they did was they sat with each other and they began to allow themselves to envision this different kind of world. And that's what we need to do in building a spiritual politics. We need to have people come together in their workplaces and in other institutions in which they are connected and envision what would it look like if this institution had a new bottom line of love and caring and generosity and kindness, etc., ecological sensitivity and so forth. What would this institution look like? And the only rule is let there be no reality police in that discussion. The reality police are the voices in your head that are saying it'll never happen, it can't happen, so there's no point in even thinking this way. And so if you get rid of the reality police and then allow yourself to have this conversation, we will build the kind of movement that can be transformative. Now, in the book, I try to lay out many, many particulars of how it could look. But that's just my view. That's just my particular perception. We are building a network of spiritual progressives. And by the way, you can find out more information by looking at our website, www.spiritualprogressives.org, spiritualprogressives.org, to find out more of that. But you'll find a lot of the details in the book. But that book is one perception. And the movement that we're talking about can't simply be Rabbi Michael Lerner's movement. We're talking about something much, much broader, and not in which we will argue out and think out how to take these ideas forward. But let me just suggest one of them to you, which I sure will appeal to some and be offensive to others. It's only one way of me attempting to say, well, how would you go forward with this? Well, I've done that in relationship to one set of institutions, namely corporations. And what we've put forward in the network of spiritual progressives is the notion of a social responsibility amendment to the federal Constitution, the SRA. Probably will never pass, but the ERA never passed either, and nevertheless, it had a tremendous impact in changing the discourse and understanding of tens of millions of people in this country. The struggle for it had a tremendous impact in this country. The SRA says the following, that every corporation with an income of more than $50 million a year, so we're not talking about mom and pop operations here, every corporation with an income of more than $50 million a year must get a new corporate charter once every 10 years. And that new corporate charter will only be granted to those corporations which can prove a satisfactory history of social responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens. We're not going to create some government regulatory body, because we know that the regulatory bodies, the people who are regulating, often end up in bed with those whom they're supposedly regulating. So we want to trust ordinary citizens just as we trust them to make decisions of life and death over the life of individuals. They can make life and death decisions over the future of corporations if the corporations cannot satisfactorily convince them that they have an adequate history of social responsibility. That, by the way, is not an anti-corporate measure. It's on the contrary. There are, I want to make it clear that from our perspective, there are millions of very decent, morally oriented people in corporations. They would love to have a new bottom line. They would love to have a way to be more ethically and ecologically sensitive, to be more kind and generous in what they're doing. Only they will tell you from the very top on, down, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their investors to maximize their investment, and that they in fact would get tossed out, possibly even sued, if they didn't make decisions based on how to maximize their investments. So they are caught in a system. It's not that they are evil people running most of our corporations. It's not true. There are very many, many decent people there, but they're caught in a system. The social responsibility amendment will come to help them, because they will then be able to turn to their corporate boards or to their investors and say, hey, I had no choice but to be more ecologically sensitive. I had no choice but to make our corporations more generous and kind and trying to promote different kinds of values here, because otherwise we're going to lose our corporate charter. So I was being worrying about your fiduciary responsibility, and that will free people who really want to do good to be able to do good. This is a specific point that I'm making of create situations in which people's interests align with their values rather than have to be in conflict with them. Well, this is only a beginning, and there are many, many other things I can talk about perhaps in the question and answer period, but they're laid out in considerable detail in the book Left Hand of God. So what I want to say is that there's a general feeling, however, when you get to hear this, in which people respond with, yeah, this is great, but it'll never happen. In fact, I got this. Some of you may have heard this because I was so impressed with this first experience that I had of talking about this to a group of Methodists in Kansas, and 400 Methodists, and afterward they were so excited about these ideas, and then they came up to me afterwards and said, but it'll never work. So I said, well, why will it never work? They said, well, you see, the only people who will like these ideas are Methodists in Kansas. So I said, well, why do you think that? They said, Because we're smart people. We watch television. We read newspapers. We read magazines. We know that the people on the coast are narcissistic materialists, that all they care about is themselves and as much money as possible. We know what those lawyers in Boston are doing. We watch the television show. We see the shared assumptions of what people have. They're all out for themselves all the time. It's impossible to ever expect to change that. Now, on the other hand, when I talk about this in Boston or in New York or in Washington or in Seattle or San Francisco or Los Angeles, people say to me, yeah, this is terrific, but middle America, they'll never buy this. And this is the thing that keeps us. You see, all of us believe that we would love to live in this kind of a world, and we're certain that it's only our friends or the members of our church or synagogue or our particular group or our particular union or our particular political movement. They're the only ones who really have any kind of idealism, and everybody else is stuck. So everybody is feeling this about everyone else, and because everybody feels this about everybody else, everybody continues to act in the same old way, namely the way that to be a rational maximizer of self-interest, because they feel that there is no alternative. There's nothing that they can do given that everybody else is that way. In other words, they don't know about you and you don't know about them. The media keeps all of us invisible to each other. And so the fact that there are tens of millions of people in this country who desperately want a different reality is never visible because all of us decide instead to be realistic and to compromise with the reality that we hate. Now, I'm here to ask you to not do that anymore, to come out of the closet as spiritual people. And by that spiritual people, I'm not telling you should become religious. I'm not telling you should, if you are religious, terrific. If you're not religious, but you have a spiritual consciousness, you know that there is something in the universe, or you understand that people have these spiritual needs, that there's something in the universe about love and caring and generosity that isn't merely a whim like chocolate ice cream or versus strawberry ice cream, that there's something fundamental about reality that needs that love and kindness and generosity. Come out of the closet as spiritual people and say to the people who are asking you for money for support for this, that, or the other project, yeah, it's good, but it doesn't go deep enough. We need to transform the left in that way so that it can be a deeper articulator of this vision, if that is possible. I'm not guaranteeing that it's possible, but we definitely need, the only way we're actually going to be able to change this country fundamentally is for you to go for your highest vision. That can happen. The Network of Spiritual Progressives is one of the directions to come. I invite you to join us, to become part of it. Let's change it together.